seated. Court is ready to hear arguments for petitioner in Hammerly Oaks v. Edwards.
May it please the court, Mr. Kevin Jewell will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The issue we're addressing here today in this case, generally stated, is what quantum of evidence is required to sustain a gross negligence finding and exemplary damage award against a corporation. Specifically, in our case, whether there exists legally sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding of gross negligence here based on the conduct of Marilyn Montgomery, Hammerly Oaks' leasing agent, who was found by the Court of Appeals to be a vice principal. Hammerly Oaks is seeking a clarification from
the
court.
And as you get through with that, you also have to look at alternative arguments that would also support it.
That's correct. There are other.
And you'll do that.
Yes. We seek a clarification from this court of the amount and quality of evidence required to show sufficient responsibility for someone to be characterized as a vice principal. To address this issue, I think we need to look to the roots of what the vice principal concept is, as stated by this court in Fort Worth Elevators versus Russell and its progeny. The fundamental underpinning of that case was that in order to recover exemplary damages against a corporation, the grossly negligent act must be the very act of the corporation itself. Acts of ordinary employees or mere servants will not suffice to bind a company to exemplary damages. Also, the type of employees whose actions are considered to be the actions of the company, or the corporate entity, are a limited group of people. Traditionally, they have included people such as corporate officers, those with the authority to employ, direct, or discharge employees, those in whom the business has confided the management of the whole company or department or division of the business, or those engaged in non-delegable duties. Only two of those are really an issue in this case. With that said, what are the problems we have here with the Court of Appeals' opinion in this case? I think primarily there are threefold. The first of which is the Court of Appeals' opinion impermissibly expands the vice principal concept to include employees that were not originally intended to bind a company to punitive damages under this court's jurisprudence.
Was Britton the vice principal?
Yes.
But not Montgomery?
Correct.
And what about Smoketech?
Smoketech was not a vice principal because he was, for starters, an independent contractor. In this case, he was not an employee of Hammerly Oaks. The only way that he could be a vice principal is if he was performing a non-delegable duty, but that issue has been waived and is not before this court.
You say it's waived. I thought they said in reply form that the Court of Appeals judgment should be upheld because Smoketech was performing a non-delegable duty as a matter of law.
Well, I think that the existence of or what constitutes a non-delegable duty would be a question of law. However, whether Smoketech was actually performing a non-delegable duty in this instance is not a question of law. And that was, in fact, I believe, the record will show, shows conclusively that he was not engaged in the performance of a non-delegable duty because his duties did not involve securing the apartments, as testified to by Montgomery and Britton. I think the Court of Appeals opinion is correct as it discusses that issue in footnote 4 about why the issue is not one of law in this case and why Edwards was required to object to the charge in this case, that being the definition of vice principal, or at a minimum submit an appropriately worded instruction. or definition, and he did not do that, and has thus weighed that issue in the Court of Appeals. And I've also not challenged the Court of Appeals' conclusion in this court by perfecting his own appeal.
Does the jury's finding that he was not in the course and scope, does that have any bearing on this issue of non-delegable duties?
Well, the jury's, that question about the course and scope on its face is limited to whether or not the jury finds that Snowtech actually participated in the assault. I'm not sure that that encompasses whether or not he was performing a non-delegable duty in terms of securing the apartments. We believe that the Court of Appeals' conclusion that Montgomery qualifies as a vice principal indicates the need for clarification from this court on the level of responsibility required to establish someone as a vice principal, not only to assist the Courts of Appeals, but more importantly, to guide the trial courts in their preparation and submitting of the charge, because this issue frequently comes up during the charge conference. What evidence is enough evidence to satisfy someone as a vice principal? Well, I first suggest that a title designation by itself is not enough. Just because someone is a manager or called a manager by a corporation does not necessarily mean they should be a vice principal. The term manager means different things to different companies. By the same token, just because someone is not designated as a manager does not necessarily preclude them from being a vice principal as well. I believe authority of this court in Purvis v. Pratko supports such a proposition where the court focused upon the scope of authority granted to the employee rather than a title designation as determinative of the managerial capacity. We would also suggest that mere authority or hiring and firing decisions by themselves are not enough to meet the vice principal standards, or exercising on the part of the employee a small amount of discretionary tasks and things of that nature. We believe that what we're talking about here is an identifiable, concrete type of authority granted to the employee showing responsibility for the overall affairs of the company. Someone with the general power to control the company's business.
What that means, this is a definition or instruction by the court in the charge, is that right?
That's correct.
Vice principal means?
That's correct.
Did your client object to that in the trial court?
I think that the instruction as it was submitted was the instruction submitted by us in the trial court.
So the jury finds whether they're vice principal or not based on your submitted instruction?
That's correct.
It seems to me like what you're arguing for today is considerably narrower than what you submitted on your own in the case.
My point is,
but didn't you say just a minute ago that hire, discharge, or direct employees is not enough? Did you say that?
I said that.
Well, that's what you submitted.
Hiring and firing alone should not be enough.
So it takes indirect employees.
I think it takes a substantial decision-making ability.
Well, but you didn't say that in that instruction.
It does not say that in the instruction. That's correct.
And so aren't you stuck with it?
We wouldn't be stuck with it.
Well, how can you argue differently?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons we're requesting a clarification from the court.
Well, how can we clarify what you've already said you think the law is when you tried the case?
Well, I agree with you. We will live and die by what is contained in the charge. Fortunately,
do we have to have a policy reason why we want to agree with your assessment of what the definition ought to be today? For different purposes and different reasons. And then what is the policy reason?
I don't think that necessarily dispositive of the issues before us today. Fortunately, I don't think it matters because Montgomery did not have the authority to hire and fire
anybody. Even under this definition?
That's correct.
So is this the right case to try to make your policy point then?
Well, she did not have the authority to do that. It's undisputed. To hire and fire, whereas Britton did.
Well, but was Britton grossly negligent?
Absolutely not.
But Montgomery was.
Well, I don't believe Montgomery was either. Montgomery, in order to...
So even if she was the principal, if she wasn't grossly negligent, your argument is still good that you're not liable.
That's correct. Even assuming she is a vice principal, which she cannot be, in order to find her grossly negligent, she would have had, or her conduct would have had to pass the Morrell test, both the objective and subjective prongs, and it does not in this case. Subjectively, there is no evidence in the record that Montgomery actually understood what the risk of harm was to Edwards when Gonzalez communicated his statement to her. I think that when someone communicates or says something like Gonzalez did to her in just out of the blue, in everyday practice, people don't tend to make good on threats like that. And she does not understand when he says such a thing that he really means to do it. And most importantly, there's no evidence in the record that indicates from prior instances or circumstances that Gonzalez was likely to do this. To Montgomery's knowledge, Gonzalez was a good worker. He had no prior complaints or conflicts with other tenants. She had no reason to believe, no reason to be on notice, that this might come to be.
When he said that to her, had he already been fired because he didn't have a machine?
Had he already been fired?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, he's an independent contractor. I believe that he communicated to her.
Terminated in whatever his capacity was.
I think he communicated to her that he would not be able to clean carpets anymore because he didn't have a machine. I don't think it was a question of whether or not he'd been fired. My point is, I think, for the vice principal conduct, what we're talking about is a person that has substantial decision-making ability along the lines of policy formulation or choosing the direction of the company, generally, or the authority to act on behalf of the company without prior approval from superiors. And I think what we're suggesting is consistent with the current state of tort reform in the state, including recent clarifications of this court with regard to necessary proof of gross negligence. For instance, I direct the court to the new venue statute, which makes a distinction or draws the type of distinction we're after here when determining when a corporation is subject to venue in a particular county. A corporation or venue is only proper to a corporation when they have a principal office, that is, an office where policymaking type decisions are made for the company beyond just the mere day-to-day operations of a corporate agent. And I think that's the distinction that we're looking for here and the distinction that was intended by this court in Fort Worth versus Elevators, Fort Worth Elevators versus Russell.
If Mr. Gonzalez had come to the leasing office looking for a tenant who he did not know the tenant's name or where their apartment was, and no one had been in the leasing office, and so he just goes and looks through the files and identifies who he's looking for and goes to that apartment, would there be any proof of gross negligence?
If he just enters the leasing office without
permission? And it's empty.
And there's no one in there?
It's unlocked.
Well, if it's unlocked, I'm not sure.
What I'm trying to understand is, what is the purpose of there being a vice principal who makes the corporation responsible, or there not being anyone there at all?
Well, the corporation has to act through people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, corporation is it.
You may finish.
Okay. A corporation is just an entity and it has to act through persons. One of the ways in which a corporation can be responsible for punitive damage is when an employee who is a vice principal acts in the scope of his or her employment. And I think that it must be a step to take to recover punitive damages when we're talking about a particular act of an employee. I think the hypothetical you pose is not going to be, well, I have trouble dealing with the facts of our case because it's clearly not what happened here. Of course, Gonzalez was not an employee himself of the company, and his intentional conduct, probably criminal conduct in what he was doing, and going into the leasing office and rifling through the files, I don't think should expose Hamill Yost to exemplary damages at all. It was his intentional conduct.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments and respond.
May it please the court, Jim Beechcroft will begin arguments.
May it please this honorable court. What we are here today to decide, I believe, is whether or not the standard applied by the Court of Appeals is the proper standard under Morrell. Is one question, and another question is whether or not, and I think it's really the only question that has been seriously challenged, is whether or not Ms. Montgomery Griffin is vice principal. First, I'd like to say that yes, Ms. Montgomery Griffin is a vice principal of this corporate entity. The reasons I would submit to you are the following. There are those that are listed in the opinion of the Court of Appeals, which I think when Justice Dunn, Wilson, and O'Connor found those issues, they cited some examples. They are, however, not the only examples of evidence that was presented in trial and to the Court of Appeals. I would point out that they cited that the individual, Ms. Griffin, worked closely with the acknowledged general manager, Ms. Britton. However, in addition to that, she was in charge of the office and worked in the office alone. And we know that for a couple of reasons. We know that because that when she spoke with Mr. Gonzalez, she indicated that they were alone and she was receiving this information and that there was no one else in charge but her. But in addition to that, we know that that was what she said when she talked to Officer Wolf. And I don't think you'll see Officer Wolf's name mentioned, but it is discussed at the Court of Appeals level. Officer
What's
Wolf...
What's the significance of the fact that she was alone?
She was in charge. She was the one that was handling all of the decisions that were being made at the time. They had delegated to her the authority to handle issues.
You mean when a business goes to lunch and they leave the receptionist to answer the phone, she's a vice principal?
Well, Your Honor, the example I would give an answer is no. But what I would say to that is that when the person who is left behind is the person who actually interacts, for example, with the police, when an aggravated assault has been committed on the premises, because that has not been previously discussed here.
Well, there's nobody there but the janitor, and the police come running in and say, what's going on? Open this door, do this, do that. Doesn't he have to do it?
To some degree, he would have to follow the orders of the police. But he wouldn't have the knowledge and ability and authority to do the things she did. She accessed personnel files, for example, in Mr. Gonzalez, on both of the Gonzalez's, and provided that information, including the personnel files, to Officer Wolf. She told Officer Wolf that she had had these discussions with these individuals and discussed what they'd said. By the way, at trial, she was caught being somewhat inconsistent in her testimony. The jury had good reason not to believe hardly anything she or Rose Britton or Frank Smotek had to say. I would point out to you that what we're examining here today is a no evidence question. It's not weighing, for example, Ms. Montgomery's statements that what her jobs were or Ms. Britton's statements versus somebody else's. It is deciding whether or not there is some evidence in the record that says that Ms. Griffin, Montgomery Griffin, acted on that occasion with the proper authority to be a vice principal. And the answer to that question, I believe, is found in several places. In Officer Wolf's testimony, he on numerous occasions described her as the manager of the complex. He said that I went and spoke to two people, Mr. Smotek and the manager. And the manager that he's talking about is Marilyn Montgomery Griffin. He acknowledges he never met or spoke to Rose Britton at all. He indicated that while in the management office, he was given access to personnel files by Ms. Griffin. While in the management office, she was the person that appeared to be in charge. That's all, this kind of information is all contained within the testimony of an unbiased witness, and that being the police officer investigating the assault. Now, the importance of that is that it was apparent to him that she had that authority. She was acting in such a manner as to exhibit that authority, not under commands or orders from him, such as in the case of the janitor that you described, Justice Hay, but because she was in the office as the management personnel.
But do you think that's equivalent to authority to manage the entire corporation or department or division of its business? Do you think simply having access to personnel files is the equivalent of authority to manage the department or division?
No, it is not.
So
and
what,
I don't
what
have
other
to
evidence?
Prove that she had the authority to manage the entire corporation. What I have to prove, and that's a disjunctive form of a list of items.
Strike the entire corporation. What evidence is there that she had authority to manage a department or division of the business?
I believe that there's evidence that she was managing subcontractor corporate employees, the exact assailants in this crime, by the way, that she had the ability to assign where they did their job, which apartments they went to, that this was discussed. That's what she did. That she had the ability to manage their personnel files, to interact with them and seeing that work was performed and completed. There is no requirement that she hire or fire. There's no requirement that she write checks in order to be, for purposes of this law, operating as a vice principal. If the question was, at the time, when issues of this importance were involved, was she acting in such a manner and with such authority? And I would submit to you, combined with the way she presented herself to the officer, such that he believes she's the manager, and the way that she presented herself in the conduct that she engaged in, that she was operating in that manner. So I do believe that there is evidence, and that's the point. We're not weighing, but we're saying, is there some evidence? And there certainly is the evidence of the officer's testimony, her own admissions, and then the actual evaluation of what was she doing. And I believe that that does support the findings of her being a vice principal. And it would support the court below's findings in that regard. I quite frankly, in all candor, feel to the court, I wish they would have given you more of these details that I'm giving you in their opinion, so that you could see that there was more than merely some statement that she was acting in close concert with the manager or that she interacted with the carpet cleaners, because the evidence was greater than that. The evidence, and they didn't even mention, for example, Officer Wolf, which I think is a very important witness in that regard. It's also important, I think, to note that she did not seek authority from someone else. She had apparent authority. She did not ask permission to obtain personnel files. She did not go to someone else to make a judgment decision. And what is the element, the fundamental aspect of being a vice principal or manager? It's when you exert your judgment in important issues, when you're given the ability to do so. And even Rose Britton acknowledged that this woman had, by that I mean Ms. Britton, had the authority to exercise her judgment and evaluation. Obviously, it was very bad judgment. The conduct, and I would emphasize to you in Officer Wolf's testimony, it's not once, but on many different occasions that he refers to her as management, manager, management office, and the only person that he spoke to was her, other than Mr. Smothek. Since she held herself out in that manner and had that apparent authority, I believe it is reasonable that the jury could follow that, and that's the evidence they would look for. And that's the evidence the jury had in front of them that they could have relied on. I think it's the kind of evidence the Court of Appeals and this Court can rely on in that regard. We have a case of a brutal assault where a person is told by an angry individual, and by the way, she deviated back and forth in the use of the word agitated, aggravated, angry, upset, but ultimately the testimony was that angry, aggravated, upset individual who's lost his livelihood, who can't work, who can't make a living, who has a person he thinks to blame, he's wrong, but he thought he had the right person to blame, and says, I want to beat it out of him. I'm looking for him. I'm going to try to find him. Then she takes no efforts to prevent him from being on the premises. He's allowed to just roam around the premises, which is acknowledged by Mr. Smotek, who sees him roam around the premises and speaks to him. Quite frankly, I believe the evidence will suggest Mr. Smotek was complicit, gave them the ability to get in the apartment and commit the assault. The coincidence of the vacant apartment being immediately next door to my client's apartment is more than a mere coincidence. I guess the point we're making here is it gets worse. They talk about the Morial standard. Can anybody honestly say that when someone says, I'm looking for your client to beat him up because I've lost my livelihood, that is not something that puts you in subjective awareness of a risk of serious injury?
What were the exact words?
Your Honor, that was debated. Officer Wolf, again, said that when I talked to her, she said that they indicated they were looking for him to attack him and to beat him up, and they were going to try to find him. There's a lot of variety of different things that he worded. She, at her deposition, and she changed her words between the deposition and the trial, which we cross-examined her about that, she said a stronger way the first time, and then the trial said that, well, all he really said was that I don't want to make this a quote, but I believe it, that I would like to find it and beat it out of him, implying that it was just a wish list. He says that, however, she acknowledges, while angry, aggravated, agitated, upset, and without livelihood. Your Honor, the clear import of the statement was, if I find this guy, I'm going to beat him up, and he did exactly what he said, except he also stabbed him multiple times and used a co-assailant to commit the crime in a secluded area where they could ambush him behind closed doors, provided by the fact this company has not one single policy regarding following the city ordinance as you lock the door. Not an oral policy, not a written policy on a vacant apartment. There's a law that says they do, just like the same ordinance in Nixon versus Mr. Property. Same exact ordinance, or virtually the same ordinance, applies in Houston. And they had no procedure to implement that. Nothing in place, according to leastwise Ms. Britton and Ms. Montgomery. The fact is that they set up the opportunity for the crime to be committed in such a manner. But when
do you have a jury finding on the failure to? Do you have a jury finding on the failure to secure the door?
What we have is jury finding on negligence and gross negligence. But we believe that as a matter of law, the evidence presented, because they did not controvert that there was no procedure, policy, written or otherwise, training or anything that dealt with complying with the city ordinance, then as a matter of law, they are in violation of that. And I believe that therefore we didn't have to ever prove that the issue of vice principal act to become surplusage in that gross negligence question in that regard. They didn't deny that they didn't have those policies and procedures. And I believe that that alone, and that goes beyond, by the way, I would admit, I suggest, beyond just the ordinance. It also goes to Rose Britton acknowledging that in an apartment complex of 520 units, that she had no policy or training procedure about security, what to do if someone comes or if you receive knowledge of a threat against a tenant. There was no procedure. They didn't even have so much as something that says call 911. And yet, you're in a situation where you're going to deal with people and in a situation where that would be a very, I think, reasonable expectation that it could occur.
They'd was there nothing. Evidence that after the assault they did nothing to assist the tenant?
It's worse than that. After the assault, Mr. Smotek was concealing and destroying evidence. He was actually cleaning up blood off of the walkway where my client had drizzled blood from the vacant apartment where he was attacked trying to get home. He was hiding and concealing it. He did not call the police. They did not call the police. Furthermore, they offered no medical assistance. Now, there came some dispute over some of that, but I thought it was interesting what Officer Wolf said when he described, and Officer Tungey also describing Frank Smotek, and Officer Wolf describing Mr. Smotek and Ms. Griffin, that they both were nonchalant. That was his word. They were nonchalant about the whole thing. They just didn't really care that this man, and they didn't know the degree of his injuries. He'd been stabbed multiple times. His nose was broke. He was beaten brutally and terrorized for an extended period of time, and they didn't care. They didn't do anything, and they didn't care.
Well, after the assault, they did not go to his, where did he go?
He went back to his apartment First he called a friend. Then he called 911. The police came on his call. They did at some point, and I do not recall in all candor the details of why or how they did it, but at some point, Ms. Britton testifies that she did go to his apartment with another person, and they knocked on the door. I do not remember what drew her attention to go to that apartment. I don't know if it's because the police were there or Mr. Smoten said something. In all candor, I wasn't looking for that in my review of the record. It could have been Mr. Smoten went to them and told them. I don't remember. But they didn't take any affirmative action on his behalf. If you ever want an example of conscious indifference, I think you got it. If you want a corporate entity that doesn't seem to care about the 520 apartments, people that live in those apartments, you've got it.
Would you go back and is it your position that the, by not adhering to the ordinance, that that's gross negligence?
Yes, sir. In fact, I would say that not adhering to the ordinance, when an ordinance is designed for the specific purpose of the safety and welfare of the tenants of the apartment complex and for the public at large also, in order to secure vacant apartments, and then they consciously disregard that ordinance, they don't even have any procedure to comply with the ordinance. Don't have anybody that they claim, at least, was supposed to comply with the ordinance. Now, I disagree with the testimony. I think at some point it became apparent that Mr. Smotek was supposed to check doors on his rounds, although they seem to deny that in the form of the testimony of Ms. Britton. So if that's true, then they're claiming that not only do they not follow the ordinance, but they don't even intend to follow the ordinance.
Well, now, does the testimony you're talking about their nonchalance and indifference after the fact of the assault, are you asserting that that's grossly negligent?
Yes, sir, it's after the fact. But it is some evidence of what their candor, what their circumstances may have been before the fact, when after you not warned a tenant about to be assaulted, somebody's threatening, you have not asked the security guard or anyone else to secure the area, you have not kept them off the premises, you have not ensured that the door is locked, you have not called the police. There's all lists of things that you can say that they omitted to do, acts or omissions. Their acts and their omissions both speak, you know, all the time. But when they've done all that, and then because of all that, their contract laborers, their carpet cleaners, beat this man senseless. And they've been nonchalant about it. I think that's the relevant evidence to interpret their pre-act conduct. That's the relevance of it. It's not in and of itself. I agree with the court. Proof was negligence. It is evidence to help you interpret, and I believe help the jury interpret what they've done before then. The other things I would like to address to the court is the non-delegable duty question. I don't believe, and I think Judge Owen brought this out, the court addressed the issue of waiver because we did not object to the jury charge. We didn't need to have a charge that included that question at all because of it being proved as a matter of law.
You said it's proved as a matter of law, but I thought you just got through saying that the evidence was conflicting on whether it was Smotek's duty to lock doors.
What was proved as a matter of law is that they had absolutely no, according to their testimony, no procedure about what to do in regards to complying with the city ordinance and ensuring the doors were locked. And Rose Britton, as the acknowledged manager, said that she had no procedure in place and no policy in that regard. So by that admission, I believe that it is proof. The non-delegable duty, we would have waived if the issue required us to change the jury charge, but that isn't the issue. We're not objecting to the jury charge. I would admit to you that the vice principal language becomes surplusage in that regard in those instances, but it's not something we need or have to object to, or and therefore have not waived that issue on appeal. As to Rose Britton, I would also argue that, and this is frustrating, so the Court of Appeals only picked one example for you, that being that of Marilyn Griffin, and said she's a vice principal and she engaged in this conduct. They didn't give you all the facts about her, which I'm hoping now you can see there was much more that proved her being a vice principal, including her acceptance of authority and actions and conduct. But they didn't say whether Rose Britton was or was not. They didn't say whether Rose Britton's conduct was or were not grossly negligent. And quite frankly, I think they could have added more impetus to their ruling by pointing out to you that Rose Britton is the admitted general manager. Rose Britton admitted not following the law, not having policies, not having procedures, not doing anything to ensure locks, not doing anything to ensure that these people weren't on the premises, even though she admitted they had no reason to be there. She acknowledged that. This is an apartment complex that has gates, computer codes. It's supposed to be a safe and secure environment. She, however, admitted they took no effort whatsoever to do that.
To do what?
To keep these people off the premises that had no business being there.
Well, I thought they were there to clean the carpet.
She acknowledged at one point that she knew they no longer had some equipment, therefore they no longer had any work to do. And she said they had no reason to be there after that point in time and should not have been on the premises. She admitted that. And by that admission, she's also now admitting that, well, that, and we asked her, did you do anything to prevent it? She admitted she had not.
She did, she, at the time that that happened, did she have any knowledge of the threat that had been made?
She denies knowledge of the threat. However, I would submit to you that we only look at the evidence that supports the verdict rather than evidence that would be conflicting. That would certainly be evidence of conflict, but that's not what we're not doing away here.
What evidence, I'm just trying to get at, what evidence that Rose Britton had in front of her that would lead her to be grossly negligent as opposed to negligent?
Well, first off, I think she's grossly negligent because she does not comply with the city ordinance. When you don't have a procedure to enforce the city ordinance policies of having locked and secure doors, I think you're grossly negligent already. But beyond that, I think there's a reasonable inference that she did know of the threat because she acknowledged that she knew that the equipment had been stolen or allegedly stolen. She knew that these people could not work. She knew all these that these things were going on. And it stretches the imagination to believe that her coworker, Ms. Griffin, has been told that, by the way, they think that our tenant did this, that that's not communicated to her, and or that there's a threat made against that tenant.
There's no evidence of that. You're just saying that that's a reasonable inference.
I believe it's a reasonable inference. And again, we are allowed to rely not only on the, first off, only the affirmative evidence, none of the conflicting evidence, but also reasonable inferences from that evidence. Your Honor, thank you very much for your time. And for these reasons, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the court below and allow justice to be in this case.
Counsel just spoke quite a bit of Montgomery's acceptance of a great deal of authority. I do not believe that is borne out of the record. There is no evidence of the scope of Montgomery's authority when Britton was absent from the premises. It's undisputed that Britton was the one who could write checks and perform all the other, or had the, all the other managerial authority vested in her. When she wasn't there, there is no indication from the record that Montgomery could magically go and write checks for the company and bind and hire and fire people and do all those things. She did not stand in the shoes of Britton when Britton wasn't there. I think that any attempt to categorize Montgomery as a vice principal solely because of the nature of the tasks she was performing, as counsel attempted to do, and I believe to a certain extent the Court of Appeals attempted to do, conflicts somewhat with this Court's opinion in Ramos versus Frito-Lay, where the Court emphasized that the managerial capacity inquiry is based more on the actual scope of authority rather than whether someone is performing managerial type tasks versus non-managerial type tasks. I would also like to add briefly the language quoted by the Court of Appeals in their opinion regarding Montgomery's testimony about how she worked closely with Britton, et cetera, was testimony listed by defense counsel and objected to by the plaintiff's attorney, and the trial court sustained that objection. And the grounds for his objections were that this testimony Montgomery gave was non-responsive in narrative. The trial court sustained the objection. That evidence cited by the Court of Appeals is not properly in the record anyway. That evidence cannot be considered by the Court of Appeals because it could not have been considered by the jury because they were instructed not to consider matters not represented by evidence. I also challenge the contention that anything Britton did after the incident in question could somehow implicate or satisfy the gross negligence test in this case. She clearly did not have any knowledge whatsoever about this threat. It was not communicated to her. She was not present on the premise when that statement was made. The fact that I just don't see how there's any evidence there, even circumstantially, can give rise to subjective awareness on her part. And I don't think what she did after the incident has any bearing whatsoever on what her state of mind was before the incident in question.
Is there any evidence that someone at Hamerly Oaks knew that, that the plaintiff was injured before the police arrived?
Not to my knowledge. As I recall, Britton testified that she called the ambulance as soon as she found out there was an incident. If there's anything that I'd like the court to remember about the argument today, I really want to impress on them that they should reform the judgment and affirm the trial court.
Any other questions? That concludes the argument for this call. That concludes the court's oral submissions for the day. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right.